Chapter 28. His change, then, cannot be described as a conversion. There was nothing edifying about it. When he came home and examined the pistol he would never use, he was seized with disgust. When he greeted his mother, no unfathomable love for her welled up. He lived on, miserable and misunderstood, as before, and increasingly lonely. One cannot write those words too often. Morris's loneliness, it increased. But a change there had been. He set himself to acquire new habits, and in particular those minor arts of life that he had neglected when with Clive. Punctuality, courtesy, patriotism, chivalry even, here were a few. He practiced a severe self-discipline. It was necessary not only to acquire the art, but to know when to apply it, and gently to modify his behaviour. At first he could do little. He had taken up a line to which his family and the world were accustomed, and any deviation worried them. This came out very strongly in a conversation with Ada. Ada had become engaged to his old chum Chapman, and his hideous rivalry with her could end. Even after his grandfather's death, he had feared she might marry Clive, and gone hot with jealousy. Clive would marry someone. But the thought of him with Ada remained maddening, and he could scarcely have behaved properly unless it had been removed. The match was excellent, and having approved of it publicly, he took her aside and said, "Ada, I behaved so badly to you, dear, after Clive's visit. I want to say so now and ask you to forgive me. It's given a lot of pain since. I'm very sorry." She looked surprised and not quite pleased. He saw that she still disliked him. She muttered, "That's all over. I love Arthur now." I wish I had not gone mad that evening, but I happened to be very much worried about something. "Clive never said what I let you think," he said, "either. He never blamed you."
"I don't care whether he did. It doesn't signify."
Her brother's apologies were so rare that she seized the opportunity to trample on him.
"When did you last see him?"
Kitty had suggested they had quarrelled. "Not for some time."
"Those weekends and Wednesdays seem to have quite stopped."
"I wish you happiness. Old chap is a good fellow. For two people who are in love, to marry strikes me as very jolly."
"It's very kind of you to wish me happiness, Morris, I'm sure. I hope I shall have it, whether I am wished it or not."
This was described to Chapman afterwards as a repartee.
"I'm sure I wish you the same sort of thing you've been wishing me all along, equally."
Her face reddened. She had suffered a good deal, and was by no means indifferent to Clive, whose withdrawal had hurt her. Morris guessed as much and looked gloomily at her. Then he changed the subject, and, being without memory, she recovered her temper. But she could not forgive her brother. Indeed, it was not right that one of her temperament should, since he had insulted her centrally and marred the dawning of a love. Similar difficulties arose with Kitty. She also was on his conscience, but was displeased when he made amends. He offered to pay her fees at the domestic institute whereon her soul had been so long set, and although she accepted, it was ungraciously, and with the remark,
"I expect I'm too old now to properly learn anything,"
she and Ada incited each other to thwart him in little things. Mrs. Hall was shocked at first, and rebuked them, but finding her son too indifferent to protect himself, she grew indifferent too. She was fond of him, but would not fight for him any more than she would fight against him when he was rude to the dean. And so it happened that he was considered less in the house, and during the winter rather lost the position he had won at Cambridge. It began to be, "Oh, Morris won't mind. He can walk, sleep on the camp bed, smoke without a fire." He raised no objection. This was the sort of thing he now lived for. But he noted the subtle change, and how it coincided with the coming of loneliness. The world was likewise puzzled. He joined the territorials. Hitherto he had held off on the ground that the country can only be saved by conscription. He supported the social work, even of the church. He gave up Saturday golf in order to play football with the youths of the college settlement in South London, and his Wednesday evenings in order to teach arithmetic and boxing to them. The railway carriage felt a little suspicious. Hall had turned serious. What? He cut down his expenses that he might subscribe more largely to charities, to preventive charities. He would not give a halfpenny to rescue work. What with all this, and what with his stockbroking, he managed to keep on the go. Yet he was doing a fine thing, proving on how little the soul can exist. Fed neither by heaven nor by earth, he was going forward, a lamp that would have blown out were materialism true. He hadn't a god, he hadn't a lover, the two usual incentives to virtue. But on he struggled with his back to ease, because dignity demanded it. There was no one to watch him, nor did he watch himself, but struggles like his are the supreme achievements of humanity, and surpass any legends about heaven. No reward awaited him. This work, like much that had gone before, was to fall ruining, but he did not fall with it, and the muscles it had developed remained for another use.